Welcome to the ABM Conversations Podcast, the number one podcast for B2B marketers wanting to explore timeless account-based marketing strategies to drive revenue, customer engagement, retention, and everything that makes sense to both marketers and sales folks. No more fluff. No more vanity metrics. Live from India, made for the world.
Hello and welcome to another brand new episode of the ABM Conversations podcast. And this is me, your host, Yag. In today's episode, we are going to discuss what a market network is and how it bridges the gap in today's marketing and advertising. An interesting topic always calls for an interesting guest. To share his insights, we have with us Sam Mallikarjunan, the CEO and co-founder of OneScreen, an AI-powered market network that transforms out-of-home advertising into a measurable medium where brands and ideal audiences connect. Prior to OneScreen, Sam was the chief revenue officer at Flock and the head of growth at HubSpot Labs. He also taught advanced digital marketing, innovation management, and strategic economics at Harvard University. He speaks at events around the world about startups, business, and marketing. With that, Sam, welcome to the show. How's it going?
Going well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure. All right. So let's get started. Sam, you've always been experimenting with ads, campaigns, so on and so forth. So I think a great place to start this episode would be if you can share the clever campaign that you did back in the day that got you hired at HubSpot. Would you mind sharing that story, please?
Yeah, so you got to understand that I was AM, FM hot talk radio show host talking about cigars and scotch. And I ended up being like the go-to website building person for the cigar industry because like I knew how the internet worked. And then they were all like, okay, like you built us this website. How do we make money with it? And I'm like, I don't know. That's not my problem. But then I started Googling around, found this amazing company called HubSpot that was talking about this concept called inbound marketing. And really fell in love with it. But, you know, I had no previous marketing experience. I was a college dropout, didn't have a degree. They're a bunch of Harvard, MIT people. And when you know you're going to lose, it really frees up your opportunities to be creative. So I bought the domain hiremehubspot.com and built a landing page to register for the free webinar on why you should hire me. And then I got free ad credit. The free ad credits you get when you sign up for like Google, LinkedIn, Facebook. Yeah. And I just targeted people who worked at their company. Got about a third of their company converted in 3 hours and 26 minutes after I hit go, got a call from their recruiter. So the rest is history.
That's amazing. You know, you say that you don't have a marketing background, but can't get better than this. Absolutely love the story.
Yeah. I didn't know it was called account-based marketing at the time. I just knew that like, I wanted to put a lot of effort into getting the attention of a specific company.
Right, right. Absolutely. That's amazing. All right. So to the meat of today's content, you know, I would absolutely appreciate if you can demystify what a market network is and how does it work? I mean, for us in the SaaS world, we have quite often heard of the term marketplace. Is it something similar?
So marketplace is a component. A marketplace facilitates transactions between buyers and sellers. And then you've got networks you're familiar with. Think like G2 Crowd, Yelp, things like that. Right. It's a reputation, helps you find, you know, who you want to work with. And then we're all familiar with SaaS, which helps manage the workflows between different people. So a market network combines all of those components. So HoneyBook is a great example. Let's say you're an event planner. You don't have an event until you have a venue and a photographer and a caterer. So you need a network to help you find and decide which, you know, venue, network, photographer, caterer to work with. You need a marketplace to be able to pay them. But then you need the workflow tools to be able to say, like, who's doing what, when, and where, you know, communication between the multiple moving parties. So a market network or a SaaS-enabled marketplace takes the concept of a marketplace and allows it to be used in a more complicated concept than just buying, you know, products and services on Amazon.
Right, right. Can I imagine it to be the likes of the Yellow Pages of the past?
Yeah, Yellow Pages was a network with a manual marketplace, right? Well, it didn't actually facilitate the transaction, but it was the original network, right? It said, you know, who was in each category. And that's an important first step, right? Like until you know, like I love G2.com, until you know who are all my options for HR software, you can't begin to decide who you're going to work with. And then when you layer on that reputation element, and then you layer on the ability to pay, and then you layer on the ability to collaborate, that's where you end up with an easy way to buy and coordinate with multiple providers. Like, you're building a house, you don't need just one company. You need, 20 different companies from the yellow pages.
Right. Absolutely. And I can't help you ask, how did the idea of OneScreen come up, and how did you even come up with this name?
So the idea of OneScreen was actually an accident. When COVID was hitting hard last spring, myself and some other former HubSpot alumni, we got together to try and find a way to help small businesses survive the lockdowns, because they had reduced capacity, et cetera. And we remembered how, after the Boston Marathon bombing, HubSpot and other tech companies had adopted bars and restaurants in Boston. We basically just opened a free tab for a while to help them recover. And that was great, but it wasn't super scalable, and it only helped bars and restaurants. Right. And so we're sitting in a cigar lounge, and the TV's turned off. And we're like, what if there was a Google Display Network for the real world? It's 2021. I'm a beer marketer. I should be able to buy TV commercials just in bars. And then the person who owns that TV should be able to get paid for it. It's exactly how the internet works.
Right.
And so we built that prototype. Then we did what we half-jokingly called a reverse stealth mode. We called all of the companies in this space and explained to them what we were trying to do, and found the out-of-home advertising industry is filled with wonderful people, but they are not technical.
Right.
One person's like, you're talking to us about machine learning and we're still using Post-it notes. So that's when we decided to create a company that would not just take TVs inside bars and restaurants, but, billboards and wrapped cars and wrapped ice cream trucks and sponsoring Little League teams, take all of this and put it into a central marketplace. And the name came from, I was drinking whiskey and I had to pick a name. So that's how we got the name.
Okay. I've never heard such an explanation for a name. I thought it would be related to, getting the ads on your mobile screens or something like that.
Well, I mean, the real rationale was marketers think too much about screens, and you should reach people, not screens. And the internet has two types of screens, or we've got the desktop or laptop, we've got the mobile device. But the only screen that matters is the screen that's useful to the person you're trying to reach. And the same person will react differently to the same message in a different time and context. And so our whole, the hill I will die on is reach people, not screens. There's only one screen, and it's the screen that's useful to the consumer, instead of obsessing over TV screens and mobile devices and cinemas and billboards. No, none of that matters. What matters is it useful to the person you're trying to reach when you're trying to reach them?
Absolutely. Love that. And two lines from one of your case studies that really struck out for me, which goes out-of-home advertising is the missing piece that makes your marketing and advertising more powerful. And the odds are that your competitors have overlooked at it entirely. So can you connect the dots for me as to how, out-of-home advertising makes marketing and advertising better, or what is the gap does that fill?
Yeah, it's quite ironic, actually. I tell the story about I was director of marketing at University of South Florida, and they wouldn't let me buy Facebook ads because that wasn't an approved marketing expense, but I could buy transit ads. Ever since there's been people, there's been somebody writing this week's Mastodon specials on the side of cave walls. It's the oldest marketing medium there is. But it's been completely ignored, right? I've bought billboards twice in my career. Once was just to piss off a competitor. All we do is we think about, can we spend more on Facebook, more on Google? And it's something people probably don't even really know what it means. It's a terrible name for a category because it's the only one that defines itself by what it isn't. But if you're a CBD company, you can sponsor pizza boxes. Probably nobody knew that. If you're trying to sell to a specific business, you can find out the bars and restaurants those people go to. You can advertise in their elevators. You can, buy the billboards that are on the roads that those specific employees take to get to work. And so it's been separated as this nice to have. You give it to the brand team, but it hasn't really been invested in. But what's weird is that it's still growing. It's the only traditional ad medium that's still growing. It's doubled in the last 20 years. While, the internet has grown much, much faster. But linear television, direct mail, radio, everything else has been dying. Out of home has been growing despite how fragmented it is. So if you can take the same digital methodologies, right? Like, who do I want to reach? What's the outcome I want to drive? What's the message I want to reinforce? Take that same knowledge that we think about with mobile advertising, think of the world as a website, or think of the world as an internet of places, create experiences to reach the people that you want to reach. So the internet's hard, man. It's been ruined by people like me doing 5,000 A/B tests on AdWords. And if I wanted to spend my whole life working in spreadsheets, I'd make a lot more money working at JP Morgan. Out of home, if you can make it easy to buy, easy to discover, and add that data layer, you can do really impactful, measurable campaigns that your competitors are completely ignoring. It's like paid social was back in 2006 when I was at the University of South Florida.
Right. And how has the COVID impacted this kind of typically imagine a lockdown kind of a situation where nobody is going out. So how does it impact the overall out of house ads?
Yeah, COVID accelerated the maturity of this industry by a decade. So it's people still using spreadsheets and fax machines. The marketers were kind of okay with the fact that there was no data because it was the brand marketing teams. They weren't really measuring much.
Right.
But when COVID hit, on the supply side, sales tanked by up to 90-95%. People who had never not given Christmas bonuses were now doing layoffs. And then on the demand side, marketers, the historical data that used to power this industry, like Nielsen doesn't even sell their place-based advertising audit data anymore because it used to just be based on historical data. So it was kind of like, okay, good enough, still growing slowly. But then, COVID was one of the guys from Publicis, called it an asteroid strike for advertising, where suddenly the supply side and the demand side had to acknowledge that the way they were doing things wasn't the right way to do things. It's also like we have screen fatigue. We're all tired of watching Netflix, like CTV. We're all caught up with our friends on Facebook. Like being locked inside for a while oversaturated us. Like we're so oversaturated with the traditional digital channels that now that people are going back outside, we like looking up. Right, we like looking around and seeing, the world around us. We like a road trip, even if you don't go anywhere, is like a thing now. So it was very, very bad for the industry for a very short period of time. It cut 25% off, $10 billion in economic value fell out of the out of home industry. But not only is it expected to recover, it's actually expected to start growing faster now that both marketers are demanding more and the supply side is accepting the fact that they have to offer more.
Right. I think this revenge shopping trend is also further adding to all of this.
Yeah, we have one company that's an e-commerce retailer, and they're actually worried because their people going to their competitor is now an outing, right? Like going to a store is now like an outing with your family. Whereas like e-commerce, again, with the oversaturation issue, and then you combine all of this with, the stuff that's happening with iOS 14 and, Facebook ads and Google ads are about to get a lot more expensive and a lot less effective. Marketers they need a place for their budgets to go, and people want to be out of home. And fortunately, there's a way that you can reach them and create experiences while they're out of home.
Right. In fact, I was surprised to read one of your articles where you spoke about, going to a Blockbuster outlet. And I was like, do they really still exist? I was like, wow.
Yeah. My last year at HubSpot, I was living in a van driving around the country with my wife. I was speaking at keynote events and I was doing some teaching. I was also shooting a documentary called Innovation on the Edge, because I think a lot of the best ideas do not come from New York, Boston, San Francisco, Seattle. And I interviewed this woman in Fairbanks, Alaska, who had managed three generations of hourly employees, and they still have a Blockbuster. And It's not because they have crappy internet. Like I was streaming Netflix off of my Verizon hotspot totally fine. It's because, there's a lot of military families there. It was actually an outing. Interestingly, this is relevant. It was an outing. They had puzzles, they had game nights, they had candy. They had transformed the experience of going to Blockbuster from just being like a catalog of movies that you can get to being an experience with, people, like human-based search engine recommendations, like an actual, turns out a high school student's better at recommending movies than Netflix's artificial intelligence algorithm.
Right. Yeah, in fact, back in the day, I picked up movies only based on a recommendation from my friends. Absolutely. 100%. Right. Let's talk about the micro moment inception that you folks talk about on the OneScreen website. What are micro moments? If you can share a couple of examples and give us some insights on how the inception happens.
Yeah. I mean, we know this intuitively, that the same person will react differently to the same message received in a different place and time. And what the internet does not have is contextual metadata. And what I mean by that is, what is happening around a person and what is going on in their life? So as an example, we have an advertiser in Boston who's a liquor store. And there are 3% of people who go to the liquor store and then go to work. And I'm super interested to find out who they are. But in general, if you want to reach somebody when they're going to go to a liquor store, don't try and reach them when you think they're on their way to work, right? Like, marketers think that, like, we think way too much about ourselves. We don't think about the context of what's going on. Right. Even TV commercials inside bars and restaurants. If it's a crowded bar or restaurant and your TV commercial doesn't work without audio, you're wasting money. Or if you're in a crowded urban center and you're running TV commercials in bars and restaurants for cars, you're also wasting money, right? So, like, that concept of what else is going on around me, what's going on in my life, and what matters to me at that point in time. Like account-based marketing, you want to reach them on the way to work, as opposed to, you know, the liquor store, you want to reach them on their way back after they've had their meetings for the day.
Absolutely. You know, I am really loving your examples. It's so on point and cannot get across the point any better. Absolutely love that.
This is real data too. I'm not making this up.
Absolutely, I'm sure. All right. So with that, you know, we are inching into the next section of our podcast, which we call the rapid fire section. And now I'm going to shoot 5 pointed questions at you. And my attempt is to see if I can put you on the spot. So are you ready for that?
Let's do it. I'm nervous. Let's do it.
All right. Here's my question number 1. Everyone talks about value, but if you can explain the practical value of OneScreen to someone in the simplest of terms, what would it be?
Value is subjective. Some people value time. So agencies like that, it makes it take less time to do the things that they were doing anyways. But for me, the value that has me so motivated, this is the most fun I've had doing marketing since they invented paid social ads, like paid streaming video. Like, all of us are tired of being spreadsheet jockeys. And the value for me is, it is a performance acquisition medium that doesn't want to make us stop at the liquor store on the way home after work.
Absolutely love this. All right. Here's question number 2. While Rory Sutherland was on the show some time back, you know, he spoke about how understanding human behavior impacted advertising. And I want to ask you this. Do you really believe that spite is one of the key human motivating factors?
That's so funny. So I taught a class at Harvard, and I had a person who taught interrogation at Quantico for the FBI.
Yeah.
And in my class, I usually talk about how the motivating factors are fear and greed.
Yeah.
And he brought up spite. And I'm like, okay, that might get, you know, terrorists to turn on each other. There's not really a business application of that. But then, yeah, I mean, we've got one advertiser who's got a competitor that they really, really hate, and they're sponsoring their competitors. They're sponsoring the Little League team that their competitors' children go to. So their competitors' executive teams has to put on, like, their company's shirts every weekend. Like, you know, I'm not saying it should be the primary motivating factor. You know, people generally are either afraid of something or they desire something, but spite is definitely a reason that human beings do something.
Yeah, in many ways, I can even think of all these alternate pages that you see on Google is also a result of that in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I think companies take it too far, much like sports teams, right? Like, I have had people who have worked for my competitors come work for me. It's about good competition. You know, it's about who can best serve the customer, which is what I love about what inbound marketing did for the internet. As it's not about who can be most annoying, it's about who can best serve the customer. But, you know, there definitely is something fun about winning. And there's something fun about being sassy when you do it.
Right, absolutely. All right, so here's question number 3. What is your number one dipstick for product market fit?
Net dollar retention is the metric that we use. So we don't actually try and get advertisers to spend as much money as possible. We try and we measure, do they exhaust their starting account balance? And then do they load as much money or more in the second time? So that's kind of an objective metric. The subjective metric is, and that's what we track. That's what our customer success team is measured on. Right. If it's $2,000 and then they load $2,001, that's fine. If it's $200,000 and they load $201,000, that's fine too. You know, I sit on as many customer calls as I can, and it's just hilarious to watch people sit there and whisper, wow, right? Like I'm not measuring fun. We don't have enough customers. I'm doing like a net promoter score yet either, but it's really fun, to see these marketers who are sponsoring ice cream trucks and, you know, doing these really creative campaigns, which is why we got into marketing, right? And that for me is the fact that our customers find it fun and can still go back to their CFO and justify spending more money, that subjective and objective metric is the reason I know that we're doing something interesting.
Absolutely love this. Amazing. All right. So here's question number four. Here's one line that you wrote that I absolutely loved. It goes like, refusing to act without perfect data is just as stupid as refusing to act based on data. So can you expand on that, please?
Man, you really read a lot of my stuff.
I love doing that.
like I said, the marketing teams have gone from being seen as the team in the corner playing with crayons to having to draw a straight line from every dollar out to every dollar in. And that's not how it works. When I teach, I do this thing where I drop a pen. How many times out of 100 it'll hit the ground? I could stand in Harvard Square handing out $101 bills, and at least 20 people will like call me a chowderhead and insult my parents. Like, it's an irrational thing to do.
Right.
You don't necessarily need, if you wait until you have perfect data, you've probably waited too long. I have a tattoo on my back that said fortune favors the bold, but the line is only visible in hindsight.
Okay.
The line between boldness and stupidity is unfortunately only available, visible in hindsight sometimes.
Right.
So if you make decisions, very important decisions with no data, that's not an intelligent thing to do. But if you refuse, we do not live in a world in which at least we can understand a deterministic future. So if you wait until you have absolutely perfect data, you will never act and you will lose to people who have a greater level of boldness and courage. So there's a fine line in there between you want data that I tell the team, it's okay to be wrong as long as you're consistently wrong and directionally correct. You want data that's directionally correct. So that you can make good decisions, but you just have to make a better decision than the other decisions that you could have made. You do not have to make perfect decisions with perfect data.
Right, right. This is amazing. You know, I think when I listen back to this episode, this particular line, I'm going to cut out as a snippet and probably listen at least once every day. I'm loving this. All right, so here's the final rapid fire question. This is going to be super easy. So if you were to suggest me saying, Yag, you need to have this one person on your show for sure, who would that be?
Oh, I don't know why you think that's an easy question. I've gotten to work with so many brilliant people. You know who I would say? There's a guy named Scott Brinker, who's chief MarTech.
Yes, he's been on the show.
Oh, never mind. Darn. Let's see. Okay, Marshall Van Alstine from MIT. Have you had him?
No, I haven't.
His book on platform strategy combined with Scott Brinker's, like it's a little bit more esoteric, but it completely changed the way that I think about business. It's not like we think about businesses as like lines of armies with soldiers lined up against each other fighting, but thinking about the relationships between ecosystems is, for example, it's hard for me to explain to our competitors or our customers, right? Like, and our investors. Like, why am I not charging for this thing that we could charge for? Well, it's because I need to grow the ecosystem and you can't sell cars in a country without roads.
Right.
Like, a lot of those philosophies around how we think about creating enterprise value and a business that has a big impact on the world, the people like Scott Brinker and Marshall Van Alstine are the people who I think are thinking about it in a new way, but they write academically dense books and not enough people read them. So get him on your show and do a rapid fire with him.
Definitely. I would love to do that. And I'll also love to check his book. By the way, this point that you mentioned, I think it also goes very closely to something that you spoke about some time back in terms of, companies not using their pricing strategy enough. Like they're not using those components of pricing enough to make sure that they are looking into the ecosystem properly.
Yeah. Pricing is the greatest lever you can have. I was doing some consulting call on HubSpot. I don't work there anymore, so I don't have any material non-public information. HubSpot's greatest growth lever was pricing,
right?
It was how do we make so that somebody can come in at a price that makes sense for them and then grow into a price that makes sense for us without it being this like crazy nickel and diming, you're always paying for a different price thing.
Right.
And when I was at Labs, the things that kept me up at night were, or even now, the things that keep me up at night are like, what happens if you can take your opponent's core functionality and make it free? And actually, there's a tweet that I have kept bookmarked, Hiten Shah from 2014, where he says, if you want to attack an 800-pound gorilla, do what HubSpot just did. Take the opponent's core offering and make it free.
Right.
And that was our strategy at HubSpot. Like, we took the CRM that Salesforce, we wanted to go toe-to-toe with Salesforce. We took it and made it free. And there are some incumbents in the out-of-home space who are about to discover that the underlying fundamentals that their businesses are built on are things that should be free and will be free so that the industry can grow faster.
Right, right. Absolutely makes sense. And love that. All right. So as we are getting close on time, before I thank you and let you go for the day, I would like to ask you, if there is a parting message that you would like to share with our audience. Our audience are predominantly B2B SaaS marketers and salespeople with at least about 5+ years of experience.
My core philosophy, again, is like, if you do what everyone else does, you get what everyone else gets. Especially if you're a B2B marketer, if you're whale hunting, if you're doing account-based marketing, it sounds, pedantic to say you have to stand out. But like you're probably already doing as good a job as you can at LinkedIn ads and at Facebook ads and some of these other things. The find a way to create unfair advantages. That is your job. Like it's not something you should feel bad about. It literally is your job, including in your career. So I don't know. I mean, most of the folks have 5+ years. You might be looking for your next job. The number one piece of advice I give to people growing in their career is, well, just don't fire yourself from a job. It's the hiring manager's job to decide if you're a good fit for the role.
Right.
It's your job to decide the role is a good fit for you. So whether it's a new campaign that you want to try and do to stand out, or whether it's a new role that you don't know that you're 100% a good fit for, the whole world, the whole universe is designed to let you know if it thinks you're not good enough or if it thinks you shouldn't be doing something. So don't worry about solving that problem. Try and create unfair advantages in new situations that favor you if you want something different than what you have now or than what everyone else around you has.
Amazing. That's a really lovely message to, end the show. And that's really, really good. Thank you so much for that. And if the listeners of the podcast, if they want to get in touch with you, what's the best place and what are the best reasons they can connect with you for?
Fortunately, my last name is easy enough that if you Google anything close to it, you'll find me, my website, LinkedIn, Twitter, etc. You can go to onescreen.ai. I just ask that you don't blame our new head of marketing for the website. It's terrible, but that's because I built it. And, we're an early stage startup. So if anybody knows any good web design agencies, let me know. But yeah, find us at onescreen.ai or find me on Twitter and LinkedIn. I answer every message. I set aside time every week to help entrepreneurs and other professionals if I can. So reach out.
That's amazing. In fact, I loved your homepage because it felt more like, it answered most of the questions that anybody would have with respect to the topic. So I really like your website. In fact, it's not the usual website, so it's on point.
I mean, there's only a few things you want. You either want me to teach, you want me to consult, you want me to speak, or you want me to help you with your career, or you want me to donate to your charity. Like, click one of those buttons. Let me know how I can help. I'm happy to.
Amazing. All right. So thank you so much, Sam. It's been like wonderful 30 minutes or so. And you've gone so deep in some of the topics. And I would love to listen and re-listen to this podcast time and again. And really, really appreciate your time to join us on the show.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks, Yag.
Thank you so much. And for the listeners of the podcast, that's that from us in this episode. And until next time, when we connect with you with another topic and another guest, This is bye from me, Yag. Have a good day and take care.
Thanks for listening to the ABM Conversations Podcast. Make sure you subscribe and share your comments with us. We're constantly looking for your feedback, thoughts, and suggestions to make the show more relevant to you.